high power, heavy episode fueled by stories from Indian history. The three needs of a human being are food, shelter, and storytelling, and that's something that author Amish, or Amish Tripathi, also believes in. He's an internationally renowned author, diplomat, columnist, and above all, one of India's greatest intellectual exports to the world. Man, I know I keep saying that this was the best podcast and that was the best podcast, but I genuinely feel that this was that one podcast I looked forward to the most. I used to consume a podcast called The Vishal Gundal Show, which featured an episode with Amish Tripathi. And I always thought that if I ever start a podcast, Amish Tripathi's gotta be on it. You guys will know why at the end of this conversation. Get through the end of it. I assure you, this one will have an extremely deep impact on your mindset. You'll carry some of these lessons to your grave. And you know what? It wasn't even that intense, honestly. I feel that some of our podcasts get very intense. This one was easygoing. It was a lot of storytelling, a lot of historical references, a lot of learnings from the world of yoga. But above all, just a modern day conversation between two bros. If you're an Indian and if you're someone who appreciates history even a little bit, please enjoy this episode with Amish Tripathi. Also, keep in mind, clips of the episode are on our YouTube channel, The Ranveer Show Clips. But without further ado, enjoy this episode with Amish Tripathi. Mr. Amish Tripathi.
Mr. Ranveer ji.
Sir, I heard a podcast of you with one of my early mentors in my career, Mr. Vishal Gundal. And so my whole impression about you before that podcast was that you're a great fiction writer. And then that podcast just opened up my mind to your mind.
Okay, I'm scared of hearing now what you thought of me after that podcast.
I thought that, man, I should be starting my own podcast soon and having Amish Tripathi on it. So, I've heard that podcast. A lot of my listeners haven't. So, some of it will be kind of sections that overlap with that particular one. I want to begin by going back to your childhood, sir. I want to ask you about your family's dinner conversations, because that was a key takeaway for me from that podcast. Those conversations actually shaped up your character today, shaped up kind of aspects of your career today. And those conversations are also an inspiration for a lot of your books. So could you just take us back to that world?
My family was kind of quite different here. You know, my grandfather was a pandit in Kashi. So, as I used to always joke, our family had a lot of blessings of Goddess Saraswati, very little blessings of Goddess Lakshmi. That's the atmosphere we grew up in. Everyone used to read a lot. Everyone, the library or the bookshop was one of our favorite places to go through. And you know what happens with children is they don't do what their parents tell them to do. You end up doing what you see your parents doing. So if your parents read a lot, as my parents did, so there were four of us siblings, all of us also started reading a lot. And, we would read, I would read at least 5 to 6 books per month. And I've been reading at that pace for decades, okay? I think that obviously molded how I view life, how I see things. But it's not just the reading. We also were a very traditional and at the same time a very liberal family, which in traditional India is actually not a contradiction at all. In fact, the more you read our scriptures, the more liberal you'll be. Like one of the things I always say, that there are idiots who say that those who fight for women's rights are somehow being Western, American or British, which is a load of bullshit. Yeah. You know, our ancestors were deeply liberal about women's rights. Our ancestors were deeply liberal about transgender rights, about LGBT rights. You know, for example, there is, we had many law books, right, in ancient India. So there is a law book which used to say that, and it's a very conservative law book, which used to say that if a man cheated on his wife, his punishment was the death penalty. Death penalty.
Oh, wow.
If you cheated on your wife. But that same law book said that if you had same-sex relations, then it's not really a crime. Just have a bath with your clothes on. Okay.
Wow.
Okay. So I'm saying it was that conservative that it frowned on cheating on your wife. Ki matlab saale ko death penalty de do. But even that conservative law book was saying LGBT relations are okay. Right? We were very liberal. Lord Krishna was a Chandravanshi. He was a Chandravanshi. You know that, right? There are Suryavanshis, Chandravanshis.
Yeah, but you'll have to explain that to the listeners.
So our line of kings and rulers, the Suryavanshi, Surya, son, okay? And Vansh, dynasty. So the Sun dynasty, Lord Ram was a Suryavanshi. And Moon dynasty, Lord Krishna was a Chandravanshi. The founder of the Chandravanshi clan was a transgender, was a woman called Ila. Can you imagine that? The most powerful line of rulers India has ever had was founded by a transgender. She founded the dynasty when she was a woman called Ila. After founding the dynasty, later she became a man called Ila. Can you imagine how liberal our ancestors were? They were so liberal.
Wow.
They were tough as well, you know. So liberal doesn't mean like you become like a California type, liberal and weak. You can be a New York type liberal also, right? Liberal but tough. Our ancestors are like that. Liberal but tough. They're tough cookies.
What I like about your school of thought, sir, is that there are a lot of so-called mythology or Indian history experts out there. But I understand a little bit of mythology and Indian history myself. But whenever I listen to what they say, I feel like they're kind of putting forth their agenda. Whenever I listen to what you say, I feel like you're putting out knowledge, wisdom, you know, things that you've applied to yourself and you've kind of tested it out and then you're putting it out there for the public. So why did you not write these books at the start of your career? Why did you take up a regular career at the start and what happened? What caused that switch?
Bro, you live in an awesome India, man. You know, you live in an India where you can make videos on YouTube and make money out of it. I lived in an India where if you were a middle class guy, you had a few options. Ya to engineering karo, ya medicine karo, ya MBA karo, ya bhuke maro. Okay. We had no choice, man. I'm 45. You know, I had to make these choices in the 1990s, which is what I tell, you know, the youngsters today. You live in such a wonderful India. There's so many opportunities, right? Which we didn't have when we were... when we were kids. Today, the world is your oyster, man. Whatever dream you want to pursue, if you're good at it, you can make money out of it. That wasn't true for us. So, I was so risk averse that I even wrote my first two books along with my job. I swear, I'm not kidding. I resigned.
And you took 2-3 years to write your first book, right?
5 years almost.
Oh, wow. Crazy.
So, and I wrote my first two books along with my job. I resigned only after my second book, when my royalty check became more than my salary. So, we've seen those tough times, man. You know, pre-1991 India, you know, agar market mein butter aata tha, to maa jaake jaldi se khareed aati thi, kyunki butter nahi milta tha. You know, scooter khareedna hai, to 8 saal ruke hue hain. You know, telephone connection milta hi nahi tha, unless you have some contact. You know, it was, and relatively we were better off than many others, you know. It was a tough time,
So, you know how people reference Sone Ki Chidiya India, like ancient India was a Sone Ki Chidiya. And then things went wrong and often people blame, say, the Mughals or the Europeans for imperialism and things like that. But I honestly feel that if something has gone wrong, there has to be some fault of those Sone Ki Chidiya wale kings also. You know, like, they must have done some things wrong. So, that's my question to you. What was done wrong?
Bro, I couldn't agree with you more, Ranveer. Okay, it's like this. Did invaders come and do crimes on us? Yes, of course they did. Okay? The same invaders who came to India also went to the Arab world. You know, what we call the Mughals today, they were actually Turks. Okay? They didn't call themselves Mughals. We call them Mughal. They call themselves Temuria. Matlab, descendant of Temur, the Turk. Right.
Yeah.
Even what we call the Delhi Sultans today, they were all Turks. Yeah. They're from Central Asia. To us, they would have looked Chinese. They wouldn't, like Alauddin Khilji, he was also a Turk. Bro, he wouldn't have looked like Ranveer Singh. Okay. That is our Bollywood, back projecting stuff. Or Akbar wouldn't have looked like Prithvi Raj Kapoor. To us, Akbar would have looked like Xi Jinping. Okay. They would have looked Chinese. The Chinese could tell the difference between themselves and the Turk. But to Indian eyes, they would have looked like Chinese. So first the Turkic invaders came, then the European invaders came. But Ranveer, these invaders used to come earlier as well in the first millennium. They used to come, we used to beat them back every single time. Okay, Alexander the Great, who defeated one of the greatest empires of the time, Persia. Okay, but he was fought to a standstill by Porus. Porus is the Greek name. The original name was Puru or Parvateshwar. We are not sure. Okay, who was a minor king of 1/3 of Pakistani Punjab. That's all that Porus ruled. And he was able to push Alexander the Great almost to a draw, right? And Alexander had to go. He didn't even fight the great powers of that time. Nanda Empire was the great power of that time. There was a time when India was considered unconquerable. People used to try. Sabko maar ke hum log bhaga dete the. Okay. The Huns who destroyed so much of Europe, so much of Middle East. Sala, they came to India. Skanda Gupta killed them to the last man. Okay, they never dared to come back out here. There was a time when Indians used to beat every invader back. And we were the richest land in the world, so invaders used to come. Angus Madison, this brilliant British historian, has done analysis of GDPs of the last 2000 years. India was 35% of the world's GDP. For most of the first millennium, for 1000 years, even UK today is only 20% of the world's GDP. US is 20% of the world's GDP. India was that humongously rich. Okay. Science, university, we had everything. Right. And then something went wrong where a society that was the center of global trade, that a society which Southeast Asia, China, Japan used to try and ape us. Today, Indians try and Americanize themselves to raise their status. Right. Mukesh will become Mike. Call me Mike, dude. My name's not Mukesh. In those days, people like Southeast Asians changed their names to Hindu names. Chinese and Buddha, and Jains, Chinese and Japanese accepted Buddhism, our culture, right? Because becoming Indian used to raise their status in those days.
Wow.
Right? But today, becoming American raises your status. This was the kind of country we were. And then something went wrong that from the 11th, 12th century onwards, we started losing to every invader who came. From a time when we used to beat back every single invader, sala koi bhi raja chalta aake humko hara raha tha. Okay, what went wrong? This hasn't been researched enough. One of my theories, internal divisions, boss. Internal divisions. We keep fighting each other. Sala kisi aur ko harane ki kya zarurat hai? Hum khud apne aap ko hara dete hain. Okay.
Yep.
Our favorite pastime is infighting with each other. Let's be honest. Aaj bhi ho raha hai. We are facing attacks, boss, from our neighbors. And what are we doing? We're fighting with each other. Is this a time to do all this nonsense? And whenever we have done that, we have lost.
Hmm.
And one of the 100%. Things, one of the reasons I think King Suheldev's story is so important and so topical, because he proves that if we Indians are united, we can bloody defeat anyone. We are undefeatable if we are united. There's no shortage of courage. There's no shortage of that in India.
Hmm.
Our biggest problem is infighting. Yep. Our favorite pastime is infighting. Ek dusre se bas ladte raho. Find some reason. Caste, religion, language, region. Find some reason and just start fighting. Infighting. Bas.
I have a lot of questions about King Suheldev for you. But I just want to rewind a little bit. I want to ask you that pre-11th century, what was the actual strength of India? Why did we beat people that easily? Was it just the money? Like, we were rich, so we had bigger armies. Was it strategy? Was it brains? How did we beat everyone?
It was a combination of everything, man. We were like the America of the ancient world. We had the greatest universities anywhere in the world. People think Oxford, Cambridge are the oldest universities. Bullshit. Oxford, Cambridge started just 600, 700 years ago. The oldest university in the world was Takshashila in the Indian subcontinent. 2,600 years old, right? Before the invasions began, the Turkic invasions, we would have had at least maybe 20 to 30 massive universities of the scale of Nalanda, okay, with maybe 5,000, 10,000 students. Nalanda, Takshashila, Vikramshila, Mahodayapuram, Madurai, all over, Sharda Peeth in Kashmir, universities all over. We had schools in almost every small village. Okay, our temples used to kind of develop as schools and also dharmshalas for poor people. We had, you know, handwritten, you know, in ancient times, we didn't have printing press, right? So we used to have handwritten manuscripts. Okay. And if you see the number of handwritten manuscripts of an ancient culture, it gives you an idea of the knowledge production of that culture. Greece, you know, is the mother culture of Europe, right? So Greece has some 20 to 30,000 handwritten manuscripts surviving till today, which is a very good number. 20 to 30,000 mother culture of Europe. Guess how many handwritten Sanskrit manuscripts survive till today? And I'm only talking about what has been tabulated by the National Mission for Manuscripts. There are probably many more, but guess how many have been tabulated by the National Mission of Manuscripts? Greece, mother culture of Europe, 20 to 30,000. Guess how many?
I would like to say hopefully 50,000 around.
Go higher.
Oh, wow. 1 lakh?
Go higher.
Oh, okay. 5 lakhs?
Go higher.
Oh, are you serious? Okay.
I'm serious.
Let's go to 50 lakhs.
3 million. Oh, wow. Okay. It is more than the rest of the ancient world combined. Okay. And these aren't just religious texts, yeah? Maths, physics, chemistry. We were like the kick-ass knowledge seekers and scientists of the ancient world. We were extremely liberal. Women could be warriors, women could be rulers, LGBT. We were very liberal. We were the greatest traders of the ancient world. Okay. We keep hearing of the Silk Route, right? What is the Silk Route? Road pe travel kar rahe? Road pe kya travel karega? Camels, oxen. Camels or ox pe, how much can you carry, boss? For big trading, you need ships, right? Indian Ocean is the only ocean in the world where the winds change direction because of the monsoon winds. Right? Like clockwork. In the winter season, from northeast to southwest. In the summer and monsoon season, southwest to northeast. Which means you could do one round trip every year across the Indian Ocean. And at the heart of the Indian Ocean is India. So we were the center of global trade. Whoever controlled Indian Ocean controlled global trade. Emperor Vespasian of Rome had banned trade with India because Rome was going bankrupt, importing things from India. And India didn't want anything from Rome. So they were just... That's why we have so much gold in India. Why does India have so much gold? Have you ever thought about it? We don't have that many gold mines. How come we have so much gold? It is because of centuries of trade surpluses. Centuries of trade surpluses for which people would pay us in gold or silver. So all that hoard is lying here. Despite so much looting. Boss, you know, and one of the problems that I have though... In those who explore our history, there are some idiots who don't want to explore our history at all. They tell us we were a barbarian country, British came and civilized us, which is nonsense, right? But on the other hand, you have people who will keep obsessing with our past and not focusing on the future, which I think is also silly. Because frankly, we can say today, yes, our ancestors were kick-ass. They achieved massive things. Sala, humne kya kiya hai? What have we achieved till now? Right? What should we think of? Ki boss, we should be worthy of our ancestors, no? If they were the most influential, most powerful, land, they created the most influential, most powerful land in the world. Sala, we should be doing the same thing. So our ancient past should be like the fuel to drive our future, to drive our confidence. That's what we should do. Rather than getting lost in our ancient past, are hum itne... great the, aaj kya haal ho gaya hamara, and keep blaming, you know, the Turks, keep blaming the British. Arre, wo to chale gaye na. For 70 years, we've been running our country. Very bad things happened, I agree. We should speak the truth of it, I agree. But uske upar rone se kya fayda?
100%.
Abhi kya karne hum log? What are we achieving today? That's what should drive us.
So there have been two moments in my recent past, which really kind of invoke a lot of anger inside me. The first moment was in engineering college when most of my friends would say things like, why do you want to live in this country? It's a shithole. Let's leave and go abroad. Then now they've all kind of left USA. Their families are here. Their parents are alone. That's one aspect of it. I also feel that I traveled to Greece 3 years ago. And this Greek guy was telling me about how the economic situation there is horrible. But all Greeks believe that if your house is on fire, you don't run away from it. You try putting out the fire. Now, that kind of made me go back to those engineering students. And I'm like, a lot of them kind of have rediscovered their love for India and are coming back. But I personally feel like India is heading into a good time. Yeah, so that's one moment of anger. The second moment of anger is probably recently after I've become a YouTuber and become semi-famous. I feel that you kind of become very conscious of social media when your job is on social media. So I do not like people, you know, just crying on social media. I feel like if you're going to cry, also give solutions.
Exactly.
Like, but no one does that anymore. And people think it's cool to just criticize and leave the criticism out there. And often the critics are the least ambitious ones. That's also like a thing I've noticed.
Spot on, boss. Ranveer, there's this brilliant American president called Teddy Roosevelt. And he'd written this poem, okay, of that the only one who truly matters is the man in the arena. Who's fighting, he will fail only because he tries, no? And he says, critics ka to bahut aasan hai. I mean, I'm paraphrasing him. He didn't speak in Hindi, of course. Okay. But critics ka to bahut aasan hai. Side mein baithe hue, bol rahe, ye karo, wo karo, saale, tune kya kiya hai?
Okay. 100%.
Complain karna to bahut aasan hai. Okay. And the only way you can avoid failure is if you do nothing. If you're just criticizing others. But who doesn't experience failure, yeah? Haven't you experienced? Haven't I experienced? All of us have experienced failure. But the only way you can experience failure is if you actually try something. If you're not going to try anything, failure to ho hai.
That's one. So honestly, what's your intuition about 2050 India? How do you think we'll be?
I think we have to screw up really badly, which I don't think we will. I think we have to screw up really badly to not be a superpower. By that time, just the sheer momentum will carry us. You know, I think we'll either be the second largest or the largest economy in the world by that time. You know, I think we're already displaying that we have the third largest army in the world. We can fight. Boss, what is happening at our border? I'm not an army guy. Random people on Twitter are giving advice. It's like the same people who were cricket experts, you know, 1 year ago and were, you know, medical experts a month back have now suddenly become army experts. Yeah, mereko kuch nahi malum. What do I know about army things? So I keep my mouth shut, but I know I'm very clear 100% behind our army. 100%. That's what we should have, right? And leave it to the experts to do what they know best. It's like, boss, I am technologically very challenged. I'm 45 years old. I find it very difficult. I'm trying my best to learn. Okay. Now, like you've told me to do some stuff, you know, on the phone or this. Why should I waste my time arguing and questioning you? Boss, you're the expert. I'm not. Correct. So it's one of the things I think we have to learn to trust the experts. But I genuinely believe we'll be a superpower by 2050. I think the question for us, what kind of superpower will we be? Will we be like another country, which I'm a diplomat, so I can't name it, but another country which we know is an authoritarian power, which is exporting diseases to the entire world, which is using the chaos caused by its own disease, which it has exported to the world, to try and conquer other parts of the world, which is misusing trade treaties, in mercantilism, you know, to just keep money from them. Are we going to be that kind of power? Or are we going to be the kind of power, superpower that we were in the first millennium common era, where we never sent an army abroad, but yet more than 50% of the world Indianized themselves because they just found us so cool and attractive. Okay. Only once we sent an army outside the Indian subcontinent, that was Rajan Chola. Otherwise, we never sent an army to conquering, but we sent traders, we sent intellectuals, we sent, storytellers, we'll send YouTubers, right? We influence the world through attraction, not through force. Can we be that kind of superpower? That's a conversation. I think those of us who are in the public space, like you and I, that's a conversation if we can drive. I think that's our job, right? But for us to tell the army, boss, this is what you should be doing. For us to tell, economists, boss, this is what you should be doing. Boss, apne ko kya malum yaar? Okay, we can give our opinion, but at the end of the day, trust the experts. That's the way I see it.
I think when you're ambitious, you're automatically busy. And when you're busy, you're automatically respectful of other professions. But it's all the non-ambitious people who kind of are just looking for opportunities to diss.
Bro, how old are you?
27.
Okay, you're very insightful, man, for a 27-year-old. This is, only those who actually do a job know how difficult it is to do a job. अगर कोई साला साइड में बैठा हुआ है दूसरों को गाली दे रहा है उसमें क्या है बॉस कोई भी कर सकता है व्हेन यू आर डूइंग योर ओन थिंग यू रियलाइज बॉस आसान नहीं है यार पैसा कमाना आसान नहीं है काम करना आसान नहीं है अपना नाम बनाना आसान नहीं है खुद मतलब माँ बाप के कंधों पे नहीं खुद कर रहे हो माँ बाप का सिर्फ आशीर्वाद है माँ बाप का और कुछ नहीं है खुद कर रहे हो देन यू रियलाइज बॉस इज डैम डिफिकल्ट देन यू रिस्पेक्ट दोज हू हैव मेड इट ऑन देयर ओन टू बिकॉज़ यू नो हाउ डिफिकल्ट इट इज
सो सर यू वर टॉकिंग अबाउट हाउ I mean, you actually didn't say these words, but this is the vibe I got, which is that whatever your strength is, if possible, if your strength is that polished, try kind of exporting it to the world and make, India great again in your own little way.
Yes.
So I do believe you're doing that through your book. I'm definitely trying to do it through my podcast. All the books you've written, actually. Now I'm also writing my first book, which I've been writing for 3 years now. So I completely relate. Yeah, it's about health and it's a health autobiography. Struggling. I'm going to ask you a lot of questions after this.
I mean this genuinely, any way that I can help. I think you're very good for India. So any way I can help in the book, Huck say, please call me. I mean it genuinely.
100%. Thank you. I really appreciate it. But I've got to ask you bro questions about the book, because it's your first book and I'm seeing how difficult it is as a creative process. It's nothing like creating YouTube videos or articles because you have to put so much of your emotion into the book, which is exactly my question to you. I feel that there's this really cool quote that says that the three basic needs of a human are food, shelter, and storytelling. So, I know that you're the kind of person who has these ideas and these opinions that you want to put out there, but you're wrapping it up into your storytelling and, kind of publishing it for the world. So, so that's one thing I definitely want to ask you about. I want you to expand on that. The second concept I want to ask you about when it comes to writing is that, again, this is something I picked up from your Vishal Gondal podcast. You said that you are just a channel for creativity to express itself, for divine creativity to express itself. So that's why you never get arrogant about, oh, wow, I've written such a cool book. I've made such a cool YouTube video. Any creativity doesn't purely belong to you. And that's something that kind of changed a lot of things in me. That's why that podcast was that impactful in my life. But could you expand on this whole writing process for yourself? And also, did you think of the money aspect of things when you were starting out?
So wonderful you should say that stories are one of our essential needs. There's this brilliant author called Muriel Rakeinsohn who had said that the universe isn't made up of atoms. It's actually made up of stories. Yeah. and what we absorb, we are essentially story love. As a species, we are story loving people, right? And you'll find that even education works best when it's in the form of a story. Okay. Why does our present education system work? It sucks, to be honest. And why does it suck so much? Okay. Our present education system is essentially a derivative of what was the Prussian education system. Prussia was, pre-modern Germany. Okay. That was the term for it. And it was basically about one standard syllabus, one teacher, 50 students, ratta marao, sala, or pass karo. So the entire thing was somehow create a quickly scale up and create a bunch of clerks, basically. Okay. Whereas India's education system, the Gurukul and the Parshalas and the Madrasas, the attitude was very different. Teacher-student ratio would be 1:5, 1:6. And the entire thing was to create thinkers. Okay. So, which is why they used to try and teach through stories. Okay. So for example, like till what age did you study maths? 10th standard, 12th standard?
I'm an engineer, so all my life, 22.
Okay, yeah. So I did BSc maths. Okay. And maths is such a lovely subject, but our education system freaking kills it. Okay, they make it so boring, right? The foundational text for our Gurukuls for maths used to be this text called Leelavati, which was written by a rishi called Bhaskaracharya. It was from what was Karnataka, maybe 1200, 1300 years ago. Why is it called Leelavati? Because his daughter, whose name was Leelavati, hated mathematics. So he wanted to write a text for her to make her love mathematics. So he named it after her, Leelavati. Okay. And he wrote it in the form of Sanskrit poems. Okay. So it's a poem that you enjoy. Without realizing it, by the end of the poem, you've learnt a math skill. Okay. This is the way our ancient used to teach. Okay. Like the Ramayana and the Mahabharata weren't just stories. You actually learned stuff. Okay. Like think about it. I've heard the Ramayana and Mahabharata from my elders, right? Because my grandfather was a Pandit and my parents were very religious. First time I heard the section where Sugriv, you know the story, right? The Ramayana story. So
yes,
where Sugriv sends his people to go find Sita Ma, okay? Because Lord Ram has asked him. Remember that scene, right? And in the text, it has been described as Sugriv tells his people, when you go south, then this mountain will come, then this river will come, then this will come, then that will come, then this will come. Then there'll be then there'll be the sea, then there'll be this island, blah, 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 blah. Then he sends some people to the east. This mountain will come, this river will come, this kingdom will come, then the sea will come. Then they describe up to Bali, Indonesia, okay? Then he goes, describes north, up to the Himalaya, beyond the Himalaya. Then he describes west. And I remember I'd heard this in the 7th, 8th standard, when I was 7, 8 years old. And I asked my mother, "Hey, but everyone knew where Lanka was. Why is he sending his people all over?" You know, I'd asked my mother and my grandfather. So my grandfather had given this very wise advice. It is actually a geography lesson in the garb of a story. Okay. Because why do they have to describe so much in detail? You're learning geography, but in the form of a story, Sita Maa ko dhoond rahe. Okay. Or in Mahabharat, Vidur Niti is basically a governance lesson in the garb of a story. Shanti Parva is a civics and law lesson in the garb of a story. Correct. So this is how they used to teach, which is, it's one of the things our ancestors understood. Stories are so important. And yes, that's what I try and do through my stories as well. You've got it spot on. There are philosophies that I feel very deeply about. Okay. Like, there are obvious philosophies that are there at the surface level, right? So my views on women's rights, my views on LGBT rights, those are, of course, you know, the surface level, they're there. But deeper into my books, like at the heart of the Shiva trilogy, is an exploration into a philosophy that what is evil. At the heart of the Ramchandra series is an exploration into the philosophy, what is an ideal society? Okay. And then I debate issues in that, in the garb of a story. Like one debate in Ram Raja, in ideal society, it's Ram Raja, right? Ideal society, that should you follow law or should you follow justice? Sometimes the two are in conflict. What do you do then? Okay. Like there are many people when that horrific rape case had happened in Delhi. Many people saying, chaurahe pe unko phansi laga. Okay. Because that would give them a sense of justice. Right. Whereas some people were saying, boss, we're not Pakistan, boss. We're India. We have to follow due process. There has to be has to go through the court, and we're a civilized country. Correct. And what is the right decision? I don't know, because sometimes in following the law, criminals get away. Okay. Then what is the right decision? So this I show in the garb of a story as a debate between Lord Ram and Lord Bharat. Lord Bharat says the law is supposed to serve the cause of justice. If the law is not serving the cause of justice, I will break the law. Okay, that's Lord Bharat's approach. In a way, is Lord Krishna's approach, right? Whereas Lord Ram's approach is, boss, if you start breaking the law, you'll have chaos. Anyone can do whatever they want. You'll have vigilantism. Mera man aa gaya, I think this justice, main kisi ko jaake maar dunga. That's not okay. That's not okay. Everyone has to follow the law. And sometimes maybe the law will not work, but overall, society will be in a better place. What is the right answer? I don't know. I just put up this debate. Okay, it's like one of the, so there are various debates like this, and I try and put them across in the garb of a story, because then it doesn't appear heavy. But while reading the story, hopefully you will think about it, you know, and come to a decision. And we are a democracy. So what we think, our politicians will be forced to think tomorrow.
100%, sir. I feel the universe selects its writers once every 1,000 years or so. So when creativity has chosen you, you got to put it out there. So that's the question I wanted to ask you, sir. Like, honestly, for me, that podcast was kind of a turning point in my thought process. Who told you about this, you know, creativity is divinity expressing itself as you and your words? Who put that idea in your head?
This actually is something that our ancestors believed in, that they followed throughout their, you know, and you see it. And have you noticed that our ancient paintings, ancient sculptures, it does not have the signature of the artist? Have you noticed that? Why doesn't it?
Got it.
Correct? Only books would have, but even that often the books also wouldn't have. Okay. It's only now that you have to do it, nahi to hum log royalty check kaise milega. Okay. But our ancestors, the artists didn't have to worry about the royalty check because society took care of them, because society thought it was their duty to take care of them. All thinkers, all artists would get done, you know, not based on work, but just done from society, because society thought this is something that has to be encouraged. These days, we have to make our own money, so we have to put our name on it. And what is the symbology behind that? Ki main apna naam bhi nahi dalunga. That the creator is not me. The creator is the divine.
Yeah.
And you'll notice most of our stories, most of our art, most of our sculptures are all around our divine figures, are all around our gods and goddesses. It's almost like we never get bored of hearing their stories. We want to keep hearing it in different ways. And I think this is one of the reasons we are one of the few ancient cultures that is alive till today. We are so deeply attached to our stories. Right?
Yes.
There are many reasons that, look, there's this lovely sher, okay? Yunano, Misro, Roma, sab mit gaye jahan se. Ab tak magar hai baki namo nisha hamara. Kuch baat hai ki hasti mitti nahi hamari. Sadiyon raha hai dushman dore zama hamara. That enemies have attacked us for centuries, but we are still freaking here. You know, all other ancient cultures, Rome, Egypt, Greece, they've all died out. They are museum pieces. We are still standing. Okay. And there is a reason for this. There can be many reasons. But one of the reasons, I think, is we are so deeply attached to our stories. And as you said rightly, stories define us. It defines anyone's culture. And the fact that our stories revolved around our gods and goddesses is what I think makes us so attached to them. Think about it this way, yeah. Ramayana was retelecast, right? Just a few months back. It's a retelecast of a 35-year-old TV series, right? Even at that time, the production quality wasn't that good because paisa nahi tha yaar us zamane mein. Okay. And aaj ke zamane ke, you know, maapdan se, I mean, from the parameters of today, production quality is not that good. Even then, it got a higher viewership than Game of Thrones did worldwide. You know, Rama and the retelecast got a higher viewership in India than what Game of Thrones got all over the world.
Yeah.
This shows how important these stories are to us, man.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep, it's one of the reasons we are alive. We are so attached to our stories. And these stories teach us things.
Yes. Often when I reference mythology on my YouTube channels, one of the common kind of reactions I get from trolls and I, for a lack of a better word, haters is, hey, it's not mythology, it's our history. How dare you call it mythology? So this is something I didn't understand as an urban Indian kid, because I'm not saying that it's not history. It's just I'm referencing those stories with the word mythology. So, sir, what is this? Why are people so sensitive about it being a history versus it being called mythology versus it not being proven? I don't understand this. Explain this to me.
Yeah, there's a reason for this. Okay. You know, in some ways, we are reacting to the trauma of our invasions. Okay. Like the British told us, you know, that their religion is history. Matlab, it's true. But our religion is mythology. It's not true. Okay.
Got it.
Like the British told us, so many Indians believe today also that India was not a country. The British created it for us. Because there's no identity called India, which is a load of bullshit. Okay. Mm. The Vishnu Puran, which is at least 2000 years old, says Uttaram Yat Samudrasya Himadras Chaiva Dakshinam Varsham Tada Bharatam Nama Bharati Yatra Santatihi. Don't worry, I'll translate. Okay. It says that north of the ocean, south of the Himalaya, is the noble nation, Varsham, noble nation called Bharat. And there live the descendants of Bharat. It describes the Indian subcontinent. And it says, this is where the descendants of Bharat live. This land is Bharat. 2000 years ago, of course, we were a nation, boss. UK wasn't a nation at that time. India was. Culturally, we were a nation. Politically, who was a nation? You know, more than 300, 400 years ago. But we don't know our history. So somewhere in our instinct, we react to the British Raj insults against us. And we feel it as insults. But because we don't have knowledge, we don't know how to argue against it from a polite perspective. So we react with anger. Okay.
Got it.
So I think that's where this comes from. And it's also about the word mythology and history. Like we've been told mythology is not truth. History is truth. Yeah. Whereas our ancestors used to say there's only one subject which can claim absolute truth. That subject is mathematics. No other subject can claim absolute truth. It's all relative truth. Okay. Even theoretical physics is accepting that our perspective, you're an engineer, you'll understand this. Even theoretical physics is accepting that our observer bias defines the truth that we see. Like there is a theory now, there could be multiple universes. And we are in the universe that our observer bias has accepted. Right? So which means there are multiple truths. So where is the truth? Right? So our ancestors never fought over this. It was like a silly fight. Ki, my truth is the one truth, otherwise you'll go to hell if you don't believe in this. They used to say there are multiple truths. There's your truth, there's my truth. There's no need for us to fight. Okay.
Yes.
So I think a lot of us are reacting to this because of British Raj insults. And because we have not updated our education system, we have not learned enough of our ancestors. Like the British used to tell us, Indians are an oral culture. They never used to write. Bullshit, boss. 3 million manuscripts. More than the rest of the world combined. Of course we used to write. Okay.
Yes, sir.
But we've not studied it. Our education system doesn't teach it. The fault is of our education system. But somewhere in our heart, somewhere we know the British are bullshitting. The British Raj. I'm not saying today's British. The British Raj was bullshitting. But we don't know how to answer back. So we react with anger. Because we don't have knowledge. We have knowledge, then we can react back calmly. Then what do you mean mythology, history? There is no one truth. So chill. We will react back calmly. Like, even from a history perspective, Winston Churchill is a great man for the British. Understandable. He defended them from the Nazis. Understandable. But for Indians, Winston Churchill was even worse than Hitler. Boss, he killed 3 million Indians in a man-made famine that he ordered. He ordered it. Okay.
Wow.
That is more than the number of... that is almost as much as the number of Jews that Hitler killed. Hitler didn't kill any Indians, boss. But Winston Churchill killed 3 million Indians in a man-made famine that he ordered. So what is the historical truth? Is Winston Churchill a monster worse than Hitler? Or is he a great patriot? It depends on the perspective, no? For the British, he's a great patriot. For Indians, he's a monster. Because Indians can say, Hitler ne amera kya bigada tha, bhai? Churchill ne bigada tha. So which is the truth now in this? There is no one truth. There is our truth. And there's the British truth. Both are history, no? Both are history. So isme ladai kya karne ka ki mythology untruth hai, history truth hai. Is kahin bhi one truth nahi hai. Sir maths mein. Yeah. Maths mein one truth hai. Maths mein 2 plus 2 is 4. There is no observer bias. Maths mein absolute truth is possible.
Yeah, 100%. I feel just learn perspectives of other people, absorb it, and then kind of make peace with what everyone believes.
Be strong about your truth. Don't let others roll you. Of course.
For sure.
Like I said, our ancestors weren't the California kind of liberal. They were the New York kind of liberal. They're liberal but tough.
Yeah.
Darpok
nahi. Yeah. I'm going to ask you the question that might get you and me into trouble. And that's why I'm going to ask you.
Okay, I'm going to have to practice my flick or, you know, well left, one of those cricket types. Ball jaane do.
What is the truth behind the Mahabharat war and the Ramayan war actually happening? Did it happen? Were there kings who were fighting each other in human history? If it did happen, in what year did it happen?
You know, I suspect it did happen. Okay? That's what I believe. But I also believe that a lot of things were added on as embellishments in stories, as it happens. You know? Like many modern British today believe King Arthur did exist, or King Alfred or Peter the Elder did exist. Actually, there isn't that much textual evidence. It's all oral, correct? And a lot of their stories sound fantastical, but there is a kernel of truth there. I think they did exist. We haven't researched it enough to prove it. But let me just give you one aspect of it that can be used to even figure out dates, for example. So, you know, the Earth, it rotates and it revolves. That's what we've been taught in history. But have you ever seen a top rotating? A top.
So,
when it rotates, you notice it swivels a bit also. Like it doesn't rotate exactly stationary, right? Thoda swivel karta hai, rotating karte karte. It's natural, na? Hota hai. The Earth also swivels like that. Okay.
Got it.
It doesn't rotate on a rigid axis. Actually, it keeps swiveling. Okay. Mm. Like this. It swivels such that the exact point on Earth comes back to its original position every 26,000 years. It swivels like that while rotating. Okay. Every 26,000 years. Because the Earth rotates like this, again, you're an engineer, you'll understand this. The sky also changes. Obviously, right?
Yes.
Because you're perspective changes, your sky also changes. The phenomenon of where the Earth swivels like this and the sky changing, that is called precession. Okay. Now, there are heavy duty softwares for this, which can calculate that when would the sky actually have been like that. Because of precession, you can predict when the sky would have been in that nakshatra, in that, what's the English word for it? Yeah. In that configuration. Yeah. In that constellation, sorry. Yeah. In the constellations would have been in those positions. Because it's like if a sky has been described today, the only time the sky will be exactly the same will be exactly 26,000 years later. Or exactly 26,000 years earlier, because the Earth swivels, right? The sky has been described at a few times in the Ramayana and the Mahabharata. In the birth of Lord Ram, for example. Or when the Mahabharata war started, for example. You can enter that into the software and get the precise date when it would have happened. Okay. Now, this has been used to date when perhaps the war could have happened, right? Which gives some dates. Okay, I've used some interpretations of those dates in my books, in the Shiva trilogy and Ramchandra series. But has this been studied enough by scholars? No, frankly not. Okay. Indian universities, you know, you'll be shocked. Most of them don't even have a Sanskrit department. Do you know this? People who have, there are more Sanskrit departments abroad than in India. It's easier to study Arabic or Persian history in India than Sanskrit history. Do you know this?
Wow. Okay.
Historians who've written our seminal books, history books that we study. Okay. Like I've been told, Romila Thapar, who's written one of our main, seminal history books, which we all study in school. I've been told, apparently she doesn't know Sanskrit. Matlab, she can't study the original texts. She can only study what someone has translated of the original text. It's as bizarre as someone writing the seminal French history book without knowing a word of French. Will the French accept that? Okay. So our problem is not that those records aren't there. Our problem is we don't have scholars today to study those records. Okay. And like I said, there are 3 million manuscripts. Okay. So what is the solution? Salah, we have to improve our education system. See, and this thing, what I don't like is people keeping on blaming the British, blaming the Turks. I mean, Salah, the British have been gone for 70 years, yeah? How long will we keep blaming them? It's our fault. We haven't done anything. Okay. If we change our education system and start teaching history properly, start teaching Sanskrit, you think Queen Elizabeth is going to come to Jantar Mantar and do a dharna out there? Then how can you do this? How can you change the education system that the British Raj put up? Of course she's not going to do that. Why will she care? So it's our fault. Mm-hmm. We haven't done anything.
Sir, but specifically with the wars, is there, like, if you go to Kurukshetra, can you actually find some proof? Because I remember reading this thing as a kid where people said that they found some kind of proof of some kind of nuclear war, yeah, radioactivity in the Kurukshetra area. So, do you have any knowledge about that?
I honestly don't know enough, frankly, to say that. And I'll say again that scholars need to study this. You know, but that's what needs to be done. Like, I mean, there was, for example, we kept being told that Indus Valley did not have horse-drawn chariots. And so-called Aryans came, you know, and defeated the Indus Valley people, and who went south. And Lord Shiva was a dark-skinned god, and Lord Ram and Lord Krishna are the Aryan gods, fair-skinned. Now, there are many things which in the text only, Lord Krishna and Lord Ram are dark-skinned. Boss, Krishna means dark-skinned, right? Mm. Whereas Lord Shiva was fair-skinned. Karpuro Gaurang, what does that mean? Fair-skinned like camphor. Mm. Right? Mm. But one of the archaeological things that's been found is in Sanoli in UP, they have found what looks like a warrior's chariot, which would have been, which is designed such that it would have been pulled by a horse, and it has been dated to minimum 2000 BCE, which is the time of the Indus Valley civilization. And that is, wow, it's UP. So there is new research which is, you know, which needs to be studied by unbiased scholars, not from the left-wing or right-wing extremist types, unbiased scholars, and give us the truth, right? Mm. So there's this Western historian, a British historian called Graham Hancock. He's written
this
book.
Yes, yes, yes.
Oh, you heard beautiful of Graham Hancock?
Of course,
dude, sir. I'm impressed, man. Whoa, I'm very impressed. Yeah, yeah. He's a brilliant historian. I really like him.
Yeah.
So he's written this book called The Underworld, right?
Huh.
And one of the chapters in The Underworld is dedicated to India. He'd done deep sea diving off the coast of Gujarat, off the coast of Tamil Nadu. He has found what looks like man-made structures which would have been above sea level only at the minimum 10,000 years ago. Okay. Now, this needs to be studied. I don't know what the answer is, but it needs to be studied by scholars. Right?
Yeah.
And they need to tell us what's going on. We are not scholars here. You know?
Yeah.
So, it needs study. That's all.
Because you have an understanding of Vedic texts and, you know, ancient Indian history, have pandemics been mentioned, you know, as a worldwide phenomenon anywhere in history?
A few times it was. In fact, there's reasonable evidence to show that our ancestors understood some form of vaccination as well. So there was probably a form of smallpox vaccination. It would obviously not be an injection. There are some Ayurvedic texts. It needs to be explored. But you'll notice one thing though. And I'm not just talking about now. Going back to Spanish flu, going back every... India has never been a source of a pandemic. Have you noticed that? It has never been a source of a pandemic. Other countries, and especially the country which has exported this specific virus, corona, has been a source of pandemics repeatedly. Okay.
Mm.
Whereas India has never been a... We've been a sufferer of pandemics created in other countries, but we have almost never... I can't recall anything in the recent past, the last 100, 200 years, where India has been a source of a pandemic, okay, of a virus like this. Needs to be studied. Why? You know, has Ayurveda helped? Are our food habits better? You know, what needs to be... Because there could be lessons for the world on this. Because India is very densely populated. Okay. This is one of the key factors in the rise of pandemics. Densely populated. You'll notice that's why cities are much more impacted than rural areas. Because dense population, the disease spreads, right, quickly. How come India has never been a source of a pandemic?
Yes.
Needs to be studied.
Nostradamus was a historical figure who predicted the future. That in the same way, did we have some kind of a figure like that in India who predicted the coronavirus situation? Or just generally in Indian history, have we had a Nostradamus?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you read Nostradamus's original texts, actually, frankly, they look like, sala, aise likha hai, it can be retrofitted into anything. So I'm not so sure he was that brilliant a predictor. And I, you know, I'm not saying that there isn't something to astrology or prediction. There could be, but at least I don't follow it. Because the way I see it, you know, what happens in your life is a combination of two things. What happens to you and how you react to what happens to you. Okay. Mm-hmm. You have no control over what happens to you. You know, all of us are stuck because of the coronavirus pandemic, which got exported to the entire world, right, from Wuhan. Mm-hmm. All of us are stuck. We had no control over it. How we react to it is up to us. So my attitude is, then why bother about predictions and astrology? Because we have no control over it. Let's focus on what we can do, right? Mm-hmm. Otherwise, mm-hmm. often you'll find what happens, you know, people just get in that negative, are, I know mera agla 2 saal to kharab hone wala hai, to might as well just suffer. Boss, kiska kharab time nahi chalta yaar. Sabka hota hai, up downs are a part of life. What gets you through is your own attitude. Yeah? You see people who go through the toughest situations will fight it through. And so many people, sala, you know, weak, thoda sa bhi ho jata hai, bikhar jata hai. You should focus on what you can do rather than what the world is doing to you.
One thing I strongly believe is that businesses, just like people, have karma. And I feel like there are a lot of businesses that have taken a hit during the coronavirus situation. And I also strongly believe that as far as my understandings of yogic teachings go, that the world needs these karmic cleansing processes once every 100 years or so. And just from my observation, I'm seeing that a lot of the businesses that are affected are probably the ones that are adding to the worldwide pollution, the worldwide, you know, maybe nasha, like as in like fueling people's physical urges. I think those businesses have been affected. Does yoga, the Vedas say anything about these kind of situations, that these karmic cleanses happen once every 100 years?
See, remember, at the heart of the Indian way is, it's not about justice, it's about balance. Mm. And it's certainly not about justice from the human perspective. Okay, let me explain this in the corona situation, that the last, this philosophy in the corona situation, last 4 months have been terrible for human beings. But it has been probably among the best in living memory for Mother Nature. I mean, living, our living memory. For animals, for rivers, for plants. Correct? Are we saying that the divine thinks only about human beings and not about other creatures? Correct? So in the Indian perspective, remember, dharma is actually about balance. Okay? And sometimes justice is in balance. Sometimes justice is not in balance. It's an imbalance. Like, we human beings may be suffering, but animals, rivers, plants, they are benefiting. So we can say, boss, human beings ke saath injustice hua hai. But it is the way balance gets restored, because adharma is what? Unbalance. Human beings caused a lot of imbalance. So now it's balance is coming back. Now it's up to us. That's one of the things our ancestors used to teach us. That always live in balance. Okay. Which means paisa kamana, you know, usme koi galat baat nahi. Our ancestors were not socialists, boss. We worship Goddess Lakshmi. We worship wealth, right? But it was always dharmic wealth, not adharmic wealth, right?
Hmm.
So it was always paisa kamao, but earn it the right way. And jo kamate ho, you must give charity. Okay. Then it's in dharma. But if you're earning money doing the wrong things, and then using that money only for your nasha, then it's adharma. Correct. Then you will, it'll come back sometime. Right.
Yeah.
Vidur had said in the Mahabharata, there are two ways to waste money. One is by giving charity to the unworthy. Second, by not giving charity to the worthy. Okay.
Mm.
So this was, which meant that when you're giving charity, also use your mind. Like, if you're going and giving charity to someone who's a drug addict and you're giving him money, are you doing dharma or are you doing adharma? We know exactly where that money will go.
Hmm.
Correct? Then you're doing adharma, no? But if you're giving charity to a child who's an orphan, who has nothing, and you're helping him educate yourself, that's dharmic charity. Okay. So our dharma was always about balance. If you see it from this perspective, then perhaps even COVID starts making sense. Maybe it's injustice for human beings. So many human beings who haven't done wrong are also suffering. Is that injustice? Possibly, yes. But it's the earth finding balance again.
Yeah. And if you do believe in the theory of past lives, you never know, you know, who's cleaning up what kind of karma from when. I want to quote Mike Tyson here. And he said that, be humble in this life or else life will bestow humbleness upon you. And I see a lot of that happening around me with the coronavirus situation. But anyway, my last two questions of this podcast, because I'm sure we're going to do many more in the future. But the first question is about this book next to me, Suhail Dev. So now, what is the emotion you've written this book with? What are you trying to tell the Indian youth?
You know, Suhail Dev, let me just explain what this is about. The way history is taught to us is that Mahmud Ghazni came in the 1020s, attacked India some 17 times. And almost seamlessly after that, Muhammad Ghori came and, well, destroyed, you know, and so-called Islamic rule began. You understand why I'm saying so-called Islamic rule? It was actually Turkic colonial rule. We don't call the British colonial rule Christian rule. So why do we call Turkic colonial rule Islamic rule? Indian Muslims weren't a part of, it was Turkic. It was Turkic colonial. They weren't people who look like Ranveer Singh or Prithviraj Kapoor. They were people who looked to us, they would have looked like Chinese. Okay. But Mahmud Ghazni came in 1020s around, and Muhammad Ghori came in the 1190s. That's a 160-year difference. That's a freaking long time. Okay. And that was a time when the Turks were going around massacring much of the known world, Arab world, Europe, China, everywhere. They were going everywhere. How come they didn't come back to India for 160 years? The answer is King Suhail Dev. Okay. He put an army together and he killed the Turkic invaders to the last man. To the last man.
Wow.
Okay. Fierce warrior. Okay. Very inclusive patriot. The devastation was so deep. Mahmud Ghazni was a Turk, basically. Okay. He wasn't Afghan, he was Turk. Okay. Or what we called Afghan in those days, Pashtuns. So the defeat was so devastating that the Turks didn't come back for over 150 years. And I think King Suhail Dev's story is particularly relevant today, because what does King Suhail Dev's story signify? When we Indians are united, we are undefeatable. No one can defeat us. We can kick anyone's ass. Okay. When do we lose? When we start fighting with each other. Okay. When we start infighting, then why did the British conquer us? Why did the Tughlaqs conquer us? Why did the Temurias, what we call Mughals today, why did they conquer us? In fighting. We were fighting with each other. Okay. No one else has to defeat us because we defeat ourselves only. But as King Suhail Dev showed, if we are united, koi Maika Lal Salah hame hara nahi sakta. Okay.
Yeah.
And this message, I think, is particularly relevant today. When we have foreign powers who are trying to invade, were attacking our soldiers, this is not the time for infighting. This is the time for all of us to be united, to be together. Across King Suhail Dev brought together an army across religions, across castes, across social standing. He had Hindus, Muslims, Buddhists in his army. He had upper castes, backward castes, everyone, all castes. Okay. He had people from all regions. Okay. A united army, and we gave the among the most devastating blows to the Turks, who were the superpower of that time, because they were going around massacring much of the world. Okay. That message of King Suhail Dev, I think, is very relevant right now. We must be united.
Got it. I love how through art you're putting out messages. Again, I got to kind of echo that thought once again. So, but I'll tell you, I mean, I don't know if I'm a proper representative of my entire generation, but my observation is that everyone my age really doesn't have much of a religious divide kind of mentality in our own heads. I've never looked at a Muslim or Christian friend of mine and thought of him any differently than a Hindu friend of mine. Yeah. And I agree with you completely. And my final question to you, sir, again, this is going to be a selfish question. This is not for the podcast listeners. This is just for me. My first book, I've written it about 8 times. And in saying that, I've like gone over it 8 times. And every time I see it, I feel like I can add more. Sometimes I remove the aggression from it, because 3 years back, I was much more aggressive a guy. And I really kind of want to put out something extremely perfect. And intuitively, internally, I am feeling like I'm on a right track right now with writing my book. At the same time, I also internally know that once this first book is released, the next few books are going to come out rapidly, because I'm still kind of breaking my book virginity, if you want to call it that. So to a first-time writer, I want to genuinely become say the next, I wouldn't want to call it J.K. Rowling, but whatever, you know, in that kind of league, in the Amish Tripathi, J.K. Rowling, you know, Radhakrishnan Pillai kind of league, is reading going to be relevant 20 years from now? And what is your advice to me in terms of my own procedure for writing?
So is it a fiction book or a non-fiction book that you're writing?
It's a health-based book, whether fictional, it's not a fictional story, it's a non-fiction story. It's a story of my own life. I went from obesity to becoming a fitness blogger. So it's the story along with like health gyan, like throughout the book. It's basically the same thing. I'm trying to do storytelling, but package information.
Yeah, you know, the way I see it, first of all, okay, that I don't think reading is going to die out. But what is reading? It is about consuming a story, right?
Mm.
You can consume a story through a book. You can consume a story through a podcast. You can consume a story through a web series. You can consume a story through a movie. It's all about consuming a story, right? And one of the things I've seen is that those who are good storytellers, okay, if they're most of them, if they're honest with themselves, they can't explain where it comes from, okay? Because it's not something that you can learn. You can learn English, you can learn technical skills, you can learn maths, but how to communicate a good story was, I genuinely believe it's a blessing. You can't explain where it comes from, it just comes, right? I can see the way you run your podcast. You are a storyteller, okay? And I always believe that if you understand, because there is no learning in storytelling, it's just instinct. Like, why do you know that you can just guide a conversation this way? You don't do an analysis, you just know, right? You just know this will work, correct? Analysis can be done of camera angles, of, you know, things which, technical things which can be learned. Storytelling, you just know, instinct guides you, right? So you have it already, okay? And I believe a storyteller is a storyteller, okay? They're just different forms. Like if you're communicating your stories through a book, then you need to learn language, you need to learn, you know, things like that, okay? If I wanted to be, say, a YouTuber, then I'll have to learn things which for me are very difficult, you know, that camera angle ye hona chahiye, ye sound backup hona chahiye, ye sab mere ko chamakta hi nahi hai, you know, I'll have to learn this. But at the heart of it, storytelling, that like is just instinct, and you have it already. So my suggestion to you, like breaking your virginity, 8 years or 7 years?
the book, it's taken...
8 years.
It's like three right now.
3 years. Okay. 3 years is not that bad. There's a 7 year age, right? So don't wait that long, okay, to break your virginity. Yeah. Just jump in, man. Jump in. You're a storyteller already. Okay. You have that instinct. Okay. And that is just a blessing. If you think about it, you can't explain even to yourself how you know that a podcast has to be taken in this direction. You just know. Correct. Yes, it's just instinct, right? Which means you have that storytelling knack within you. It just is a different form. It's like that same knack can be taken into a web series, can be taken into a movie. You need to learn the technical skills. Of course, like writing a book, you need to learn technical skills. Grammar has to be right. You know, all that stuff. Okay. It's like, it's not rocket science. Yeah. Technical skills are not rocket science. Anyone, camera angles, everyone can learn, right? I say, just jump in, man. Just jump in. And I'm saying it genuinely, not just because, you know, I like this interaction. I'm saying this genuinely because I think, you are doing a lot of good for India and you can do a lot more good for India. So genuinely, any way I can help in your book, whatever. Yes,
thank you.
Hak se call karo boss. Hak se call karo.
For sure. Thank you, sir. Means a lot. From one chosen one to another. I'm sure it's the first of many conversations over the years. So thank you again, sir.
Thanks,
appreciate
buddy.
It.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.